Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anyone who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the leading edge of the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep, ongoing public dialogue about how higher consciousness can enable human beings to rise to meet our current challenges and to make as benign as possible a transition to an actually sustainable, fulfilling, and just human presence on our planet. This is part of a whole series of remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. And this morning, I'm joined by Stanislav Grof. We will be continuing that discussion in a conversation we have entitled Waking Up at Sunset. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Stan and we'll spend about an hour having a real conversation, a living exploration of this topic. And then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes or maybe just a little longer. Stanislav Grof is an MD and PhD who has conducted over 50 years of research into the potentials of non-ordinary states of consciousness. His amazing journey began in 1956 with experiences with LSD and then research he did in Prague, Czechoslovakia, where he had received his medical training in 56 when he was still receiving it. His research expanded there and then continued focusing on psychedelic therapy at Johns Hopkins in Maryland after he moved to the United States in 1967. He was probably the most prominent early and enduring serious researcher to do extensive psychedelic research and psychedelic therapy. And out of that work, he developed an extensive cartography of altered states of consciousness, or holotropic states, as he coined that term, and he became one of the founders of the field of transpersonal psychology. From 1973 until 1987, he was scholar in residence at Esalen Institute, where he and his wife, Christina, developed a powerful non-drug form of self-exploration and psychotherapy called holotropic breathwork that has constellated a significant international community of practitioners all around the world. And then he's served in more recent years on the faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies and Wisdom University until his recent retirement. His extensive research also includes alternative approaches to psychoses, understanding the treatment of psycho-spiritual crises, spiritual emergencies, the implications of recent developments in quantum relativistic physics and biology, brain research, and other avenues of the emerging scientific paradigm for psychiatric theory and consciousness studies. And among his publications are over 150 papers in professional journals. One of his papers, his legacy paper, is available for free download. Some of you have probably accessed it. It's a wonderful summary of his life work that is a beautiful introduction. You can just go to the post describing this interview at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog and follow the links. He's also written many books, including Psychology of the Future, where he summarizes life's work, his newest book, Healing Our Deepest Wounds, the holotropic paradigm shift, the book When the Impossible Happens, and also The Cosmic Game. There are also The Ultimate Journey and the classics Beyond the Brain and LSD Psychotherapy and many more. What I especially appreciate about Stan is how naturally he has functioned for many years now as really the good father and at the same time a loving brother to the community of psychedelic explorers, psychonauts, and others who have valued altered states. He's a very solid guy, even physically, but especially intellectually and professionally, grounded, clear, rational, credible, reasonable, and benign. And yet he's shared space with some of the wildest psychedelic pioneers, not just intellectuals like John Lilly and Francisco Varela and Michael Murphy, but spiritual teachers like Ram Dass and Alex Gray, but wild characters like Timothy Leary, Alexander Shulgin, and many others. And he's done what he can do to create a safe space for the larger cultural experiment that has unfolded since we first opened the doors of perception. And for that, I'm really grateful to you, Stan. So welcome. I'm really delighted to have you on this program today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be part of your program.
Well, you know, to kick this off, I'd like to ask you, you know, these holotropic or non-ordinary states have really changed your life, and your life in turn has changed the whole trajectory of our understanding and use of those states. But you started out as a pretty hard-headed rational scientist. Could you please relate, at least briefly, the story of how you became open to them, interested in them, fascinated by them, and then obsessed, and how you were turned around and turned on?
Well, I started, my interest in psychiatry by reading Freud. And this is the reason why I studied medicine, to become a psychoanalyst. But I got to a point where I was becoming very, very disappointed. And at the beginning, not necessarily was the theory, but was the practice, you know, how long it takes, how much money, how much energy it takes, and that the results are not exactly breathtaking. And when I was at a point where I was really regretting that I have chosen this career, I was working at the psychiatric department of the School of Medicine, and we finished a large study of Meloril, one of the early tranquilizers. And this came from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company in Switzerland, in Basel. So we had a very good working relationship. And in this context, we got from them a big box of ampules. And when we looked at them, it had a very mysterious kind of a title, LSD-25, and it came with a letter that was describing the history of Albert Hofmann, the ergot chemist who discovered the psychedelic effects of LSD when he actually intoxicated himself by working with it. And the Sandoz was offering us if we would like to work with LSD and let them know if there is any interesting application in psychology and psychiatry. And they gave us two tips. One was this could induce like experimental psychosis because there seemed to be some similarity with naturally occurring psychosis. And it's always great to have a model so you could give it to quote-unquote normal people and do all kinds of tests before, during, and after and get an insight what is happening biologically when the mental functioning is so profoundly influenced. And then there was a second tip that kind of became my karma or destiny. They said maybe this could be used as a kind of unconventional educational tool. You know, psychiatrists, psychologists, psychiatric nurses, students could spend a few hours in a world that is kind of similar to the world in which some of their patients are living, and as a result of it be able to understand these patients better, be able to communicate with them more effectively, and hopefully be more effective in their treatment, which was kind of sorely needed. Psychiatry was in a situation where we were using medieval kind of means like insulin comas and electroshocks and so on. So I got very excited. This seemed like an opening of a new perspective. I became a volunteer. And my preceptor who got the LSD was very interested in EEG and particularly in something that was called driving the brainwaves, exposing people to powerful stroboscopic light of different frequencies. So in order to have my session, I had to agree to have also my brainwaves driven. And this just was such an overwhelming experience of cosmic consciousness, where I had the feeling my consciousness left my body. I felt completely extinguished, and I had a sense of becoming everything there was. And when I came down from the session, for a while it was very difficult for me to align my consciousness with my body. And it became clear to me that what they taught me at the university, that consciousness is somehow a side product of the neurophysiological processes in the brain, simply was not true, that consciousness was a cosmic phenomenon, an integral part of existence, and that our brain somehow mediates consciousness but doesn't generate it. And I was very, very impressed. And, since that time, the study of non-ordinary states became my passion, my profession, my vocation. You know, it's now over 50 years, and I have done very little that would not be related to non-ordinary states, or particularly the significant subgroup which I call holotropic. So that's a very brief history.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm really, it's nice to hear it, sitting here now after you've done so much for such a long period of time, too. You know,
maybe, Terry, before we continue, maybe I should just say a couple of sentences about holotropic, because we were using that term, and you already used it talking about holotropic breathwork. So I was specifically interested in a very important subgroup of non-ordinary states that have healing, transformative, and I believe even evolutionary potential, and also heuristic, H-E-U-R, which means they can be source of a completely new revolutionary information about the human psyche, about consciousness, and even nature of reality. Let's say the experiences that the shamans have as part of the initiatory crisis, or the states that they use in healing their clients, the kind of states that are induced in rites of passage or healing rituals of different cultures, the experiences that the initiates had in the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, and also the experiences of yogis and Buddhists of different orientation, and Taoists and Kabbalists and Christian mystics and so on. And I was just flabbergasted that there was no special name for these states. In psychiatry, we call them all altered states and basically see them as pathological. And so I really believed in the amazing significance of these states, and I decided to coin a term for them, and I started calling them holotropic. And that literally means moving toward wholeness. Holos is whole in Greek, and trepo, trepein, means moving in the direction of something. And, you know, if it surprised somebody that it implies that we are not whole the way we experience ourselves in everyday life, I would say that is the basic finding of this work, that we identify only with a small fraction of who we are, that our ultimate identity is with the cosmic principle itself, like what the Hindus call Atman Brahman, or the Tao, or you can call it cosmic Christ or great spirit and so on. So that's the term holotropic, name for a special subgroup of non-ordinary states.
You know, that connects to something I'm curious to talk with you about too, which is that there's a huge taboo against drugs, but there's also a taboo really against ecstasy. And you've been working with legal restrictions and professional resistance your whole life, and you know, much of that, I think we can all agree, is pretty wrongheaded. But there are some critiques that have been made that have some basis. You know, certainly many people who have legitimate higher state experiences also can become deluded by those experiences. And even Ram Dass, for instance, you know, his whole search in India was originally framed like I don't want to come down. The idea that states tend to be transient, you know, that they come and go is another second critique. You know, A, that they can be often deluding, and it's hard to know the difference between revelation and delusion and so forth. And then the second is that they're transient. And the third would be Ken Wilber's distinction between states and stages, the idea that stages of consciousness that actually restructure the very way you make meaning somehow have more significance than states. And it might be nice to hear you speak to those more intelligent critiques as we begin.
Well, I think it's a very, very important question. You know, these states are extremely powerful, and everything that's powerful has, you know, its potential shadow side. But on the other hand, we would not have religions, or we would not have the mystical schools without the existence of these experiences. These are experiences that opened the psyches of the, you know, of the founders and the early followers and so on. I don't know any significant spiritual teachers who didn't have powerful experiences of this kind. And, you know, there are tremendous potentials. There are also significant pitfalls. Now, when you bring psychedelics into it, then it's also, you know, there's a certain skillful way of using these powerful tools, and there are certain, you know, not so intelligent ways. So it's essential, for example, to have the right kind of set and the setting. You don't want to have these experiences as part of raves somewhere where you take it, you know, in an open space where you don't know what you are taking. There is sort of nobody holding the kite string, so to say. So there could be, you know, the negative sides of a negative potential of these substances can really predominate over the positive potential. Now, the other thing is the context. There is a difference, as we have found out, and as Houston Smith suggested, that it's different if you take psychedelics in the context of kind of responsible spiritual quest, you know, where you do a lot of meditation, a lot of reading, and so on, and you're using it as a tool in this context. And that's very different from going to a party in Berkeley, and, you know, there's a fruit punch, and a jester comes with a handful of sugar cubes laced with LSD and throws it in there, and people think they are drinking punch, and they're having, you know, powerful psychedelic experiences. So if you take specifically psychedelics, there was from the beginning a very heated discussion about this instant or chemical mysticism. What does it mean? And there was one group of people who were the hardcore scientists who were saying, well, this is clear. You know, what the mystics think are some kind of profound cosmic insights is nothing but aberrations of brain chemistry. And there was another group that was saying, no, there is a group of group of substances and also plants that can induce mystical experiences, and these are special, these are sacraments, these are, you know, flesh of the gods and so on. And there was a third perspective based on Walter Penke's Good Friday experiment, where he showed the, you know, deep similarity between the psychedelic states induced by psilocybin and the spiritual states that you find in the mystical literature. And then the question was, you know, they definitely are very similar, but do they have the same value? And there were people who were saying, well, for this to be valid spiritual experience, it has to be happening in the context of serious spiritual practice, or it has to come as grace. And then there was Houston Smith who had said, well, you know, they certainly, he had himself psychedelic experiences, so he said, no, They're definitely genuine mystical experiences, but what they do for you depends on the context. You know, is it that Berkeley party, or is it part of a very responsible, serious spiritual quest when you're doing all kinds of things and where you really ground these experiences and you integrate them into your life? So this was a long answer to your question.
Yeah.
And definitely also just having a powerful experience does not necessarily mean you move, you know, to a sort of permanently higher state of consciousness. Of the states and the experiences certainly are different.
Right. So have you come to feel that there is, a need for ongoing practice in order to stabilize natural access to the implications of what's revealed in the higher states?
Well, I think to have spiritual practice is good, whether you take psychedelics or do holotropic breathwork or don't. I think that's a significant part of life that makes your life sort of fuller and more significant. Jung was emphasizing this, that we should sort of complement what we are doing in everyday life, everyday consciousness, sort of excursions into the collective unconscious and connecting with the self, tapping the wisdom of the collective unconscious, and then live your life as a kind of integration of what's coming from the outside and what's coming from the inside.
Well, I'd like to kind of return to some of the implications of these higher states, because you've really identified some key primary areas, one of them being that these states really form the basis for revising fundamental assumptions about the very nature of our minds and consciousness. And it would be good to hear you speak a little more to that particular point.
You know, I just would like to say that I speak about these things as a researcher, not as a guru. I'm not saying this is how things are, but this is what I have observed. This is what people experience when they were having these unusual states. So quite a few years ago, I spent quite a bit of time going through thousands of these protocols from these holotropic states, was looking specifically at those parts of the sessions where people were sort of asking questions about ontology and cosmology, you know, some very fundamental questions. Who am I? You know, who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? What is the nature of this universe? Has it really created itself, or is there a creative cosmic energy? Is there a master blueprint, or has it just happened as a play of material, you know, subatomic particles and so on? Asking questions, have we lived before? Why is evil in the world? And things of that kind. And I wrote it up in a book called The Cosmic Game. And what happened is that people in these parts of their sessions were sort of giving or finding answers to some of these questions that I mentioned that were really consistent. This was not some kind of a subjective, you know, idiosyncratic distortion of how things are, but they were coming with certain insights that were intersubjectively identical. They were sort of supporting each other. There was a certain kind of validation, inter-individual validation, and the whole thing came together into a worldview, into an image of the universe and our place in it that was fundamentally different from what we are taught by materialistic science. And it was very much like what you read about in Aldous Huxley's book, the Perennial Philosophy. And actually, many of the aspects of this alternative worldview that emerged were really supported by and have been supported by revolutionary findings in science, in what we call the emerging paradigm, the new paradigm, which means, you know, quantum relativistic physics, the kind of biology that Rupert Sheldrake is talking about, the holonomic thinking that David Bohm described, holographic model of the brain that Carl Pribram was talking about, and then particularly the connectivity hypothesis of Erwin Laszlo, where he talks about the psi field or the Akashic field, as he called it, where everything that happens in the material world remains holographically recorded and available to us in certain unusual states of consciousness. So I'm not saying this is the way it is. I'm just saying there are these states in which you will have a completely different sort of understanding of who you are and what the universe is about, and you get sort of, you know, overwhelming supportive evidence for that particular perspective. You know, we think that we are getting overwhelming evidence for the materialistic worldview, but this alternative worldview is, I would say, even more convincing than what we have currently in Western science.
You know, I remember a time in the 70s when it seemed that this alternative view was, that there was a convergence and an emergence of almost a consensus among many leading thinkers, who, some of whom had no experience with LSD or any of the other psychedelic or entheogenic substances. And yet, in the time since, there's been tremendous resistance to this view, not just from people who have a more traditional mythic relationship to God, but also from, you know, and maybe even more influentially, from a more scientific materialistic view, one that sees the evolution of consciousness as having arisen through material processes, and thinks that, you know, it might be that consciousness in these altered states moves to this view, but that this is an epiphenomenon, an accident of the way our minds are structured, and that when you cleave rigorously to evidence in you know, objective or exterior evidence rather than the interior evidence of people's inner experiences, that that can't be validated. And I've wondered if there's some level of extra rigor that that's asking of those of us who are spiritual practitioners and travelers in the inner realms, and whether there might be some higher synthesis that is being asked of us by that resistance. How do you view that?
Well, I will say something that probably seems heretic in traditional academic circles, but, you know, has been described by people like Amit Goswami, who is a, you know, professor of physics, and that's that we should actually start in science from consciousness, because what we really know about the world is how we experience it. For example, astronomy is not a science about stars. It's a science about human experiences of what we call stars. Now, whether the stars are there and what they are, it's a very profound philosophical and scientific question. So it actually should be up to the materialist to prove that the way we perceive the universe is the real nature of the universe. And we know that significant aspects of what we perceive is the contribution of consciousness. You know, there are no colors in the world. They are just frequencies, according electromagnetic frequencies, according to science. There are no sounds. There are no tastes. There are no smells. In other words, all this is a creation of, or addition of consciousness. The other thing is there is absolutely no proof that consciousness is coming from the brain. So all we know is that there are systematic correlations between the anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry of the brain and consciousness. But there is no proof that this means that consciousness is actually created in the brain. It would be like saying that because there is a correlation between the components in the TV set and the functioning of the TV set and the program, the images and the sounds, is a proof that the whole program is coming from the box. So there's no question that we have enormous amount of evidence that there are correlations between what's happening in the brain and consciousness, but absolutely no proof. I have never seen any paper, let alone book, that would describe how possibly could material processes result in consciousness. There is gap which is so formidable that nobody has even attempted to bridge it. So what scientists are focusing on, as you see, for example, in Francis Crick's book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, when he says, well, you're nothing but a bunch of neurons, you know, or your hopes and fears and expectations are nothing but the activity of the neurons in the brain. But then he narrows it to the process of perception and shows you that when you observe something, there are significant things happening in your retina, you know, biochemical changes, electric changes, things happening in your optical tract, and then he ends up in the suboccipital cortex, that if you watch something, there are electric potentials and biochemical changes in your suboccipital cortex. But then he leaves it there, where the problem begins, which is, what is it that transforms potentials, electric potentials and biochemical changes in the brain in a conscious, facsimile of what you are observing, and then projects it, gives it to you in living colors and projects it into space. So nobody has ever shown how you bridge that, that gap from what's happening in your suboccipital cortex, for example, and other areas of your brain, and the conscious experience that you have.
Yeah, well, I certainly...
So we should start from consciousness and then, see where that gets us. This is something that Immanuel Kant showed, you know, the difference between phenomena, which is the way we perceive the world, the way the world appears us, and what he called noumena, which is things in themselves. You know, what is it that we are experiencing? And this is sort of shoved under the carpet, under the rug, you know, in science. We look at the processes that we have some hold on, that we can study, that we can describe, what's happening in the retina, what's happening in the optical tract, what's happening in the suboccipital or the temporal cortex. But how do you bridge that gap from material processes to consciousness? That's the, you know, that's the key question that has never been answered.
And gosh, I'd love to pursue this line because it's, I think, theoretically really interesting, but there are some other topics I did want to ask you about, because when you do then start with consciousness, what you became most interested in then was the way that this transformed our whole model of understanding our psychology and psychiatric healing and the healing potentials of these holotropic states. And that's really been a big focus of much of your work over the last maybe 30 years. I'd love to hear you at least make a general statement about the implications there.
Well, we started, you know, from the major questions, which is ontological, cosmological questions. This is more specifically about psychiatry and psychology. I mentioned that I started, you know, as a traditional psychiatrist and then psychoanalyst. And there we have a map of the psyche that's actually limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious, as Freud described that. And one of the things that happened during this years of research is that I had to expand that cartography, include, for example, what I call perinatal matrices, which are the memories of the experiences that we had in the consecutive stages of birth. There's a powerful record in the unconscious of that. There's also prenatal memory that's there. And then there is this whole vast domain that Jung was talking about, which is the collective unconscious, that has the historical part where the human history is recorded, and then the what he called the archetypal, the mythological, where we have can have access to the entire cultural heritage of humanity. So I had to expand that map of the psyche to account for what was happening in these holotropic states, and created a cartography that shares with traditional psychology and psychiatry the postnatal biographical level, but is adding two very significant domains. One is related to birth, which I call perinatal, and then that other, you know, vast domain which this cartography shares with the Eastern spiritual systems, which I call transpersonal. And that, you know, then gave, when I was part of the group with Abraham Maslow and Tony Sutich, then became the name for this new psychology, transpersonal psychology. So those are the implications, you know, for psychiatry, for psychology. You'd have to expand enormously the cartography of the psyche. The current map is limited to postnatal biography and the Freudian individual unconscious. Freud talked about the newborn being tabula rasa. There's really nothing there that's of interest for a psychologist. So what we become and how we functioned is all sort of interplay of biological forces and postnatal experiences. Then the other thing is you find powerful healing mechanisms that operate on the perinatal level, the level related to birth, and also in the transpersonal domain, in the collective unconscious, both historical and mythological or archetypal, Jung would call it. Also healing, powerful healing mechanisms that are not just from the biographical level, but there are significant healing mechanisms associated with the level that I call perinatal, which is related to biological birth, and then many, many healing mechanisms related to the transpersonal level, past life experiences, emergence of some, archetypal material, mystical experiences of cosmic unity can be extremely healing. So you get a very different kind of psychology, both in terms of the cartography of the psyche, which is far, far larger than the one that's being used in academic psychiatry and psychology. New healing mechanisms, some of them operating on the perinatal and the transpersonal level, and also new approach to therapy, where you use the kind of intrinsic healing potential of the psyche rather than coming with some technique, that you're trying to change the psychological functioning of the client. You basically use this inner healing intelligence. Jung was talking about the self, which would be written in English in capital S. So those are very radical sort of changes that you would have to make in the psychology and psychiatry if you look at the evidence from these holotropic states of consciousness, as I call them.
And you've actually developed in holotropic breathwork a whole practitioner community of people who are orienting in just the way you were just describing. Maybe it would be good to at least say a few words about that.
Yeah, well, Christina and I developed something that we call holotropic breathwork, where these experiences are induced by breathing and music, a certain kind of body work. The term holotropic means moving toward wholeness, and this, it has the basic premise that would surprise many people, which is that we somehow are not whole the way we experience ourselves in everyday life, but that we experience only a small fragment of you see, our true identity, and that ultimately our identity is with the cosmic creative principle itself, and we can experience ourselves as anything in between. Transpersonal psychology has a whole cartography of experiences that you can have. You can identify with other people. You can experience group consciousness. You can identify with different animal species. You can go back into the past. You can experience things from the historical collective unconscious. You can have karmic experiences. You can also experience somehow mythological sequences from the, you know, from the mythological archetypal unconscious. So that's a very, very large sort of image of the psyche, and there are sort of healing mechanisms associated not just with the biographical level, but also with what I call the perinatal level, reliving and integrating various aspects of your birth, and then also the what we call transpersonal experiences. So the psyche in this kind of understanding is infinitely larger than how it's described in Western psychiatry and psychology. It's you know, very much like what's described in the Eastern spiritual systems, in Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and so on.
Yeah, wow. I would love to talk with you for about 10 hours, Stan, because I'd love for people to hear this rich array. I'm so glad we do have your legacy paper online. But I think we're far enough into our conversation now that it might be good to turn to the presenting question of this whole series, which is relating really to the title we chose, Waking Up at Sunset, in so many ways with the rapid warming of the planet, the extinction of so many species, the rapid growth of human populations around the world, and the breakdown of so many, not only natural systems, but even the breakdowns of a lot of human institutions and systems. In many ways, the human world is in crisis. And yet, the human world is also advancing rapidly technologically and in other ways. We seem on the verge of breakthroughs. Certainly, your work is an expression of the breakthroughs in the inner realms, and this whole series is devoted to that breakthrough to higher states of consciousness and our ability then to act together in new ways that might rise to this challenge. But we are potentially, you know, at a kind of sunset, at a point when potentials of the destruction of our evolutionary experiment are right here before us. And when we got together and had lunch and spoke about this, you offered, I thought, what was really a very important and evocative way of responding to this question, how can higher consciousness help us rise to this? You offered a vision of two scenarios, two models of how reality is expressed that show themselves very powerfully in your own experience and in the experience of other people in holotropic states, one of which you kind of dubbed the optimistic divine intelligence scenario, and the other you called the karmic kaleidoscopic scenario. I'd love to invite you to state that for everyone who's listening, and then to talk about how you hold these two scenarios as you contemplate this critical moment.
Well, you know, one of those scenarios would be that somehow the best thing that we can do is to somehow, you know, awaken to the fact that this universe is a kind of a play of consciousness, and we have very, very little possibility of changing that. And we can even get a sense that somehow things have gotten out of hand. You see, that even the divine principle sort of is not in charge anymore because it got too complex. The other one was the idea that we can somehow become participants and that we can become agents of change. So if we somehow, you know, empty the challenging or the difficult aspects of our psyche, that we can become a sort of agents of change in a sense, that we can participate in this transformation, which is a very, you know, very exciting kind of perspective. The one is just sort of you know, getting the insight that this is a cosmic game and it simply is running its own course, and the other perspective is giving us a certain active role, that if we sort of transform ourselves, if we open ourselves, that we can actually become participants or agents of change. Is that what you had in mind?
Yes. When we talked before, you elaborated it even more fully. You kind of said, in your own deep experience of expanded consciousness, that you have at times, and that you have seen others see, that the divine intelligence is pervading and in charge of everything that is going on, and that can be utterly trusted, and that the sense that one cannot trust it is utterly confused, and that relaxing into that trust of the divine's pervasion of this world and how completely it can be trusted, one kind of rests in a place of no problem and no seeking, and simply an interest to awaken into a kind of synchronicity with that. But that you've had equally powerful experiences that also have seemed so powerful as to be self-validating, in which the divine intelligence is, of course, also prominent, but in which it's more like it has set everything in motion, and that then there are these chains of cause and effect that proceed out. It's as if the divine intelligence created a kaleidoscope, but the patterns are endless, and that those can be whatever they are, and they don't necessarily work out for the best. That actually the way the divine intelligence pervades is through our consciousness and our agency, and that presuming our responsibility is necessary and important, and that these two attitudes of utter trust and utter responsibility have both felt powerfully present to you and in your own experience, and also as you've seen it in the comparison of many people's experience and therefore validating it even as a researcher, and that you now stand in a relationship to these two scenarios which seem to be contradictory in a way that never lets go of either one of them, that you stand with both of them in mind in an important way. And I wanted to invite you to to speak even more fully about how you feel about that, because the potential destruction of this, you know, beautiful evolutionary experiment, this is more than our own death, this is a vast, much vaster mortality, and in a way it's the most kind of horrible scenario we could contemplate, and how we are related to that existentially and feelingly needs to be informed by the highest states of consciousness and the truths that come to us from them. And these two alternative truths and how you're relating to them, I think that's a vitally important topic, and your speaking about that with this incredible wealth of experience, I think is of great value to us all.
Well, I think you can get, that's the interesting thing, you can get in these non-ordinary states different scenarios, and they can be presented with a certain experiential authority so that it seems the truth, but then you can also experience the other alternative with equal power. For example, you have the Aurobindo idea, you know, when the world ultimately can become spiritualized and so on, and you have also the Hindu concept of the yugas, when you have certain stages and there's destruction and then new creation happens, and you can sort of, in non-ordinary states, you can experience powerful confirmation of these different scenarios. But I think what is really important is to get involved in your own sort of inner practice, you know, as Ramdas said, if this is a situation where the world as we know it would be destroyed, then if you do some inner work, you are in a better position to face that alternative. But the better possibility is that you actually become somehow agent of change, of transformation. And he says, so, you know, whichever way it would go, I would just do what I'm doing, which is some significant spiritual practice, and see how I can contribute to the scenario that seems, you know, desirable to me. So I think it's important to get involved in this inner work and inner transformation, and that ultimately you choose your own way of participating in this situation. The fact is that when people do the work with these non-ordinary states, whether they are, you know, meditative states, or whether they are induced by shamanic techniques or by psychedelics and so on, that you get a different sense of who you are, how you are connected to the world, that you are a significant part of it, and you want to operate in a way that supports somehow the positive evolution in the world. So in a way, you sort of become a conscious agent of this transformation in the direction in which you think it should go. And ultimately, if it does not go in that direction, as Ramdas says, you know, then some kind of significant inner work will prepare you for whatever happens in the world.
So that whichever of these scenarios you are feeling is most persuasive at any moment in time, the same practice, I guess, is implied, that one in some way calm one's anxiety and by noticing the ways in which the divine intelligence is pervasive and trustable and simply open to contact with that, but at the same time presume that your way of participating may be consequential, and therefore you have to act as if you do hold a kind of responsibility to be a force for the awakening of more love and consciousness and connectivity and even a more radical transformation of culture, so that we can rise to meet the remarkable interwoven challenges that we're now facing. Is that,
yeah,
am I speaking something that resonates for you?
What I don't think I have sort of said clearly, that there is one very convincing scenario that you can see, that somehow the world is created by absolute consciousness, and that we have a certain role in it, and we basically don't have a way of changing it anyway. It just it is a cosmic play, and the best thing we can do is to be get an insight what it is about and what our role is. But we don't really have any kind of active creative participation in it. And the other one is that we actually are players in this. You can see the universe in such a way that it sort of is running its way, and you can see that the creative principle in one scenario has full control of what's going to happen, and the other one is that the cosmic principle, creative principle, just set things in motion, but that it becomes so complex that even the creative principle does not have ultimately control which direction it's going to be going. You know, this would be like seeing creation as a chess play in which certain basic principles are set, certain figures with certain predetermined movements and so on, but the person who invented chess could not possibly foresee all the different eventualities or the situations that will evolve. So it's set in motion, but the outcomes are really not fully predictable. The kaleidoscope is a kind of a similar situation, where you have an idea. If you create the kaleidoscope and you turn it, there's going to be, you know, a lot of fantastic kind of visual possibilities, but you don't have sort of a full control about what is ultimately going to evolve. So you can have also, you know, benevolent or not so benevolent scenario of the first possibility, and then also the other possibility, where you have really active role, where you can play some kind of a creative function. You become a partner, or you become a co-creator in a sense. And I think that's, you know, that's the one that's more appealing and interesting. Now, whether it's true, you know, again, it remains an open question. But it's the fact that people who undergo this kind of transformation, that they deal with their own, karmic history, with their own perinatal personal history and so on, that they operate in the world in a different way. That if there were people who undergo this kind of inner psycho-spiritual transformation, that the world would not have quite the problems that it has. Because people start feeling that they are sort of a, you know, part of creation. They're not separate from creation. Whatever they do to nature, they are actually doing to themselves. They opt for synergy rather than competition and so on. So you can see significant transformation in people who do really responsible spiritual work, whether it's with psychedelics or some other means like breathwork, or whether it's a result of spiritual practice, meditation, and so on. people certainly changed themselves, and they changed the way they see the world, they operate in the world. So it's certainly a benign scenario for the evolution of this planet.
So, are you an optimist?
Well, I have seen things that make me feel optimistic in spite of what we see around ourselves. If you look at the world, it really is not very uplifting. But I've also seen a situation. I came from Eastern Europe. I was born in Czechoslovakia, and when I saw the changes that happened in Europe, I was very surprised. Something I didn't expect. The idea that suddenly, Gorbachev would say, "Well, you Germans, you put down the wall. You can sort of unite Germany." And as far as the Czechs and the Hungarians and the Poles and the Yugoslavians are concerned, you can have your freedom. We don't have any more need to control it. I would think that you were crazy. I mean, the communists have never let go of anything that they got hold of, and yet this has happened sort of overnight. Suddenly, one superpower was gone, and so I believe that things are happening on other levels, that we don't have direct perception of. And if we judge just by what we see in the world, we might be in for really powerful surprises. And it could all be sort of part of the Leela of the cosmic game. I mean, we can find a newspaper a report tomorrow that scientists discover a strain of bacteria that feeds on plastic and releases oxygen into the atmosphere, and some kind of other fantastic scenarios like that we cannot possibly see at this point. And it would be a very interesting turn in what the Hindus call Leela. It would be a very, very surprising, radical, and exciting scenario that none of us actually expected.
Yeah.
So I am, moderately optimistic.
Beautiful, thank you. Well, we've gone a little later than I'd intended to. I felt like this piece was very important, so I wanted to continue. But we have some important announcements we want to make, and we have questions. So anyone who has a question can raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone keypad, or if you're listening via your computer, you can type in a question. I've actually received quite a few already. Now, first I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about Stan's work. First, on the web, you can go to Stanislav Grof, StanislavGrof.com, and holotropic.com. Those two websites will give you many resources of Stan's writings and ideas and links to his many books and audio programs and a variety of other resources. On StanislavGrof.com, on holotropic.com, you connect into the whole holotropic breathwork community that he and his wife Christina founded and that they continue to lead. They will be going to Berlin shortly, and on April 11th, Stan will deliver a public lecture, and he and Christina will also be there together for the Global Holotropic Breathwork Day on April 13th. His lecture will be on the 11th, and the day is on the 13th. So anyone in Germany near Berlin can encounter him in person in just a few days. And then, just 10 days later, Sunday, April 21st, The Psychedelic Science Conference in Oakland, California will be taking place, and Stan and Christina will be there too. He'll be giving a public evening lecture on the healing potentials of holotropic states at 6:30 p.m. And then that's on Sunday, the 21st. And then on Monday and Tuesday, the 22nd and 23rd, he and Christina will be leading a two-day experiential workshop in holotropic breath work. About his books, there are many. The one that probably I would mention first is Psychology of the Future, which really is a summary of his work. But the book... Healing Our Deepest Wounds, which is actually his most recent book, comes out of the fact that he was honored 6 years ago with the award that Václav Havel gave on his birthday each year. A part of that process was that he put together a book with representative samples of all his writings, which was translated into Czech, and this is the English version of that book, Healing Our Deepest Wounds. So that, in a different way, also summarizes his work. The book, When the Impossible Happens, is a series of stories of things coming out of these holotropic states, each of which is a story about something happening that defies the dominant materialistic paradigm and opens us up to this larger view. And then the book The Cosmic Game really shows the revelations of the perennial philosophy and what's coming from quantum physics and Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields and Bohm's implicit order, and Pribram's holographic brain. Those are kind of talked about in The Cosmic Game. I also want everyone to be aware of my work. You know, we've talked about spiritual practice here in this discussion, and I think that I've been able to bring together in my course, which has just recently been released for the first time digitally, a way to actually anchor one's whole life in a truly integrated understanding of all the different dimensions of spiritual practice. It doesn't just take place on the cushion. It doesn't take place only subjectively. It's in our relational life. It's in every moment of life. And yet we need to anchor it in an actual daily practice. And many of us today are really kind of confronted with the complexity of this huge marketplace of offerings, and in a way it's easy for us to work superficially, and yet it would be a problem for us to just embrace one path and screen out all the others like with blinders and not grow in all these different dimensions of ourselves. So many of us feel a bit fragmented, and I think what I've been able to do in this course is to bring together the fundamentals of what can ground your life in a whole and complete practice in a way that really enables you to range freely and still concentrate your practice in a way that actually breaks through to real awakening. And this paradox is embodied in these 8 90-minute sessions and in a whole series of other videos and audios that can take you through a step-by-step process that will really help you transition from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's really quite uncommon. It's not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's really a truly heart-centered and self-compassionate and humane path that still generates the tapas, the yogic fire that's necessary for real transformation, and yet in a simple and doable way that you can do in the midst of a busy life. So I hope you'll go to terrypattencourse.com, terrypattencourse.com, if you're interested in this, and you can make one simple choice by signing up for it and really deciding to take it that will ripple through your life and create many wide-reaching changes in your life. So I warmly invite you to do that. And then finally, please do stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you about my next guest on the program, who I'm very excited about. He's the brilliant Harvard psychologist and Tibetan Buddhist scholar, practitioner, translator, and teacher, Daniel P. Brown, the author of Pointing Out the Great Way. So let's see what we have in the way of questions. And the first one I want to ask Stan, I thought it was beautiful. It came in before we even started, but it was asked anonymously. What single wisdom sustains you most at this time in your life? And this person asked it anonymously, so I can't offer his or her name.
What, wisdom?
Yeah.
Well, I think what sustains me, you know, what I have experienced over the years in these various non-ordinary states, what I call holotropic states, where I think I have sort of made certain changes, you know, in my own psychosomatic functioning that make life more more comfortable, and then also sort of got some spiritual insights that are certainly very helpful in both everyday life and in sort of looking at the world situation.
So in a way, everything you've just been talking about is what sustains you.
Yes, in a sense.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here, let me open up the mic for someone I know, Tom Bugsby. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Terry.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome.
I've been struggling for a long time with trying to figure out how consciousness plays at the bottom line essence of everything. And I conceptualize it sometimes as we have this sense of universal consciousness of the ground of being, and then that evolved into evolution through the Big Bang with energy and information and matter being formed, and that we play this role as being individual consciousness, which is a very limited form of that universal consciousness, that when we do it together, it becomes collective consciousness, but it's still very limited in terms of the overview of universal consciousness. And that's what leads us into the problems we're in today, is we keep acting out of our individual and collective consciousness with such limited data in terms of how it's going to impact the whole of the universal field. And therefore, until we put consciousness and increasing it as our number one priority to be able to see as much of reality, much of that universal field as possible, so we can then live in integrity with it, meaning that we act consistent with this, what I call an ethical responsibility to live in integrity with the bigger reality, that would be the justification I would see for consciousness being our number one responsibility, and number two responsibility is acting consistent with the biggest level of consciousness that we can conceive at any given time. And I was wondering what you think of that version of how the world works.
Well, I think I have seen, you know, a powerful transformation in people where they move from this sort of ultra-materialistic worldview to something that was more like part of the systems of perennial philosophy, and they have sort of radically changed their way of operating in the world. So I think that we have that potential, you know, but we would have to somehow complement what we are doing in the external world with some kind of a focused self-exploration that would reach, that would also lead to inner transformation. And my experience working with these states that I call holotropic states, you know, most of my experience has been first with psychedelics and then with the breath work that we develop. So you can see people undergoing powerful changes in their hierarchy of values, in their understanding of their role in the universe, and the way they operate, where they sort of become you know, part of a kind of a synergistic system rather than a system that puts exclusive emphasis on sort of personal achievements and so on. So So I have seen, you know, profound transformation in people who complement somehow whatever they're doing in the world with some kind of a focused, systematic self-exploration that if it's done in a responsible way, leads to a transformation that includes the hierarchy of values, and you sort of emerged. You emerge with a personality that could contribute to a better future of the planet. Particularly when you deal with some of the problems that are part of your own individual history, whether it's postnatal history, childhood, and so on, or the perinatal, the birth that you had, or prenatal. So all those elements can be changed, and people emerge from it with a different worldview, different sort of understanding of existence. And we don't have to teach them. This is very interesting. As you are dealing with some of the traumatic imprints, which are from your biography, from your birth, from your prenatal life, and so on, or karmic things, then you sort of automatically develop this concern about the planet. You start feeling as you are a planetary citizen rather than a citizen of a particular country, and you develop a sense of synergy, you know, rather than exclusive competition and so on. So those are very, very exciting changes that you see in people without really trying to program them anyway. You just sort of create context in which they can deal with the problematic aspects of their individual history, and they just automatically move to a certain hierarchy of values and certain way of operating in the world that would give us better chances for survival, and, you know, hopefully eliminate some of the most toxic aspects of sort of global life. I don't know if I answered the question.
Yeah.
If you have any kind of anything that you would like to add to that.
You know, Tom, we have so many people stacked up with questions.
Yes, thank you.
Maybe we could hold it to that. Thanks so much, though. I appreciate your raising
welcome.
Your hand. We have quite a few people who've raised their hand with live questions. I'd like to maybe, if you'd be willing to go a little later than we had originally intended, Stan, I'd like
sure.
to go do that. Great. Hello. Shanti Gaya, hi.
Hi.
Hello, Terry. Thanks for taking my call. So, Stan, I have facilitated and participated in both individual and collective group breathwork,
mm-hmm.
and I've found that when a group enters in with kind of the common, expansive intent of experiencing these ecstatic states, these mystical states together, something beyond what I've encountered individually happened. And I would just like your opinion or comments on that.
Well, you know, very definitely you can see things in these large groups that you wouldn't see. For example, you know, amazing synchronicities happen that actually precede the beginning of these large groups. So when you sort of announce that group, that things seem to be happening, synchronistic things seem to be happening to people already on the way to the workshop, and then in the workshop itself, you can see, you know, quite amazing things happening when people choose their partners. They find out that they chose just the perfect partner for looking at the problems that, you know, that they are working on. So you see a lot of synchronicities that are happening in these groups, and you know, certainly the field that is created is much more powerful if you have number of people in what I call the holotropic state of consciousness. So that's definitely has been, you know, my own observation too.
Thank you.
Yeah, beautiful. Thanks so much for the question. I'm going to take some more live questions. I see that I think this is Julie Reznor in Fort Bragg. She also typed in a question. Welcome, Julie.
Hello, it's Janie.
Hi, Janie.
Janie, yes. Hello. Stan, I have just really seen your name and had such respect for the work you're doing. I'm just delighted to be able to speak to you in person. I've been on a profound spiritual journey for the last 30 years, heralding the return of the sacred feminine from the depths of soul into awakening consciousness, so that everything you describe about having your life utterly changed is absolutely true. And my question to you is, does this come up for you, the reemergence of the feminine that we really are seeing in so many places all over the world?
Well, it certainly happened in my own psychedelic sessions. My attitude towards the feminine changed fundamentally when I confronted my own birth. That was where the major changes were happening, where I was able to bring into consciousness and sort of work through some of my painful experiences with the feminine, which were related to my birth, and then sort of connected to the cosmic feminine in a completely new way. And you see it repeatedly in people, developing a very different attitude to the feminine when they are able to confront birth, when somehow by the role, in the cosmos, the feminine sort of inflicts painful experiences on as we are coming into the world. And until an deep look at it and sort of work it through, it could sort of manifest in all kinds of not so nice ways.
It seems to have worked, however. Here we are.
Yeah, you would develop, if you go through this process, you go through the perinatal level, perinatal experience, and you really integrate it, you develop a profound respect to the feminine, and you certainly would not do some of the things that we see in the world.
But I guess I'm wondering if you feel that energy, the awakening to the feminine, to being as a mother, as protecting life, as honoring life, realizing that life is sacred, that place that we really did come from a long time ago, because patriarchy hasn't been here forever, and we live thousands of years, I believe, in harmony and with gratitude for life. And on a different, obviously, in a different state. So I guess I have hopes of this returning. I expect this to return to a more sacred place in ourselves and in the world.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's definitely happening. There are many, many different ways in which it is happening, but it's certainly return of the feminine, and in a way, I think it's our only hope when that element returns into the planet.
Yeah, for sure. I want to bring in there are quite a few really excellent questions that have been typed in. A couple of them have to do with people who just want to engage more with what you're offering. Helen in Bath in the UK wants to know if there are places where holotropic breathwork is available that she could find affordable. We have Hannah in San Francisco wondering if you're seeing individuals in therapy. There are quite a few people who are moved by this. Anything you want to say about either of those questions?
Yeah, myself, I am not involved. I'm just teaching at this point. I have my 82nd birthday coming. I'm not as active, you know, as I was before. I'm still sort of participating in workshops and so on. But we have a whole network where you can, for example, try the holotropic breathwork or go through the whole training. And you can find it on our website. You know,
that's holotropic.com.
.com, yes. It would be all the possibilities. We have training for people who want to become facilitators of what the breathwork that we developed, which is called holotropic breathwork, working with non-ordinary states induced by breathing and music and certain kind of body work. But we have also trained over 1,000 people, so there are people practicing, giving workshops all over the world. And if you go to that website, you can find the place that's closest to you where you can actually participate in holotropic breathwork workshops.
Great, thanks. One other question. Well, actually, there's kind of two related questions. One from Hannah and one from Karen and Juno. Hannah asks, what do you make of all the fascination with dark, satanic-type images in our culture? Is this an effort on a cultural level to integrate dimensions of our psyche that are needing to be integrated? And does it perhaps have a healthy dimension, or should it be engaged in a healthier way?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, you know, obviously the dark side is part of creation. I mean, you cannot just take it out. You can just find sort of a different relationship with a different kind of attitude. There are certain ways, you know, you can deal with that dark side of existence. One of the ways, of course, is to do inner work where you confront this dark side experientially in a supportive, loving environment, so that you work through these aspects of that we all carry in our own personality, the shadow side. So that's the best way this can be done, when you sort of confront those forces in your own inner self exploration. Otherwise, you know, it certainly is. It is, and has always been part of existence. This dark side, and the best way, in my experience, to confront it, is that you go inside and you deal with it in experiential work, whether it's meditation or, you know, some of the things that amplify the meditation, like doing the breath work, or at the end of that line would be, sort of responsible work with psychedelic substances.
Great. That relates to Karen's question, Karen from Juno. She says that she's healing from various traumas from early childhood and young adulthood, and she has not used holotropic or psychedelic substances in her, but she's very interested in experiencing these higher states. But she's had the experience when she smoked marijuana of terrifying experiences of panic and anxiety and even hallucinations. And so she's wondering if she would have that same kind of experience if she did holotropic breath work. So I think there are probably quite a few people that are a little bit afraid to engage in these states because of fears that their own psyche will be destabilized. And I think this is probably a question that would be useful to many people, to just talk about the risks or when contraindications, and, you know, if people feel vulnerable, what is possible and appropriate.
Well, the most important thing is to find a really good sort of responsible container for that. And there are also sort of degrees, you know, of confronting the unconscious material. For example, you know, meditation is the gentlest thing that you can do. Breath work is more powerful, and then something like psychedelics are at the end of it, and they also sort of different differences between psychedelics. There are certain psychedelics that are psychologically easier to work with, and others that are more sort of you know, more powerful. I think I would just contact some of the people. There are now many people doing the holotropic breathwork, and sort of you know, connect with them if you want to try it, and just have a discussion with them, and they could sort of first of all hopefully create a very, very positive, nourishing experience for those confrontations with the unconscious, but also can sort of have some estimate how challenging or difficult these experiences might be, because that ultimately reflects people's individual history. I mean, if you had, for example, a very traumatic birth, to heal it, you would have to go through challenging experiences, and you would need a really good good support. But people who work with these states, they can sort of assess it. If you meet them and you talk with them, you sort of look at what you're dealing with. You can get some guidance in that sense. We have trained over 1,000 people, and there are, you know, additional hundreds of people currently in training for the holotropic breathwork. But there is a hierarchy, you know, from something like confronting these things in meditation, and then, you know, the breathwork and the psychedelics, and there are gentler psychedelics or, you know, very powerful psychedelics. So there are many, you know, many different ways that this could be approached.
Yeah, right. Good. Well, let's take one more live question, Stan.
Okay.
This is from somebody with a Santa Cruz, California telephone.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Hi. My name is Autumn.
Hi, welcome. Hi. Autumn.
I'm so happy. I let me get over my momentary ecstasy that you picked me as the last caller. When you were speaking about, Stan, the two ways of interacting with all that is, that the one that perhaps we have no control whatsoever, the second that perhaps we are co-creators, I kept feeling there's also a third that I'm wondering what you might, you know, feel about the way I do my best. I can't say I'm always in this state, but, you know, there are fluctuations, but I notice the fluctuations get shorter and shorter the more aware you are. But the third state being one of doing without doing. And I love that you use Sanskrit as well. That whole feeling is when you're absolutely present, when you are not labeling, categorizing, describing, using language in your brain in that state of, excuse me, I'm sorry, sort of a thoughtless awareness, that you then, you are so completely one with the being, the singular being that is all creation, that you're no longer caught up in any of these other structures or concepts, that you are participating, that you aren't participating. That is dissolves away, and there's no longer any kind of separate awareness. And I would suggest perhaps that's the third way of interacting with this lila of life and this divine sport that we're experiencing as what we call, you know, life as we know it, via the limited bandwidth of human senses.
Yeah, actually, Tev Sparks, you know, who was in our certification, now is actually leading the holotropic breathwork training that we developed, wrote a booklet which is called Doing, Not Doing. You know, doing.
I didn't know what to say. I'm, you know, I don't know that stuff, but that's great.
Yeah. And, you know, what you see in people, to the extent to which they somehow deal with their own idiosyncratic personal material, you know, their prenatal traumas, their birth trauma, their childhood traumas, and so on, they are moving more towards this kind of an operation in the world, kind of doing, not doing situation, where you you get your sort of deep traumatic imprints out of the way, and
right.
then you become sort of part of a larger whole. And what happens if you operate in that way, that somehow synchronicities happen, you know, that sort of are helping what you're doing in the world, and you sort of like, you're more like driving a wave, you know, than, you know, trying to achieve something by forcing your will.
Well, since I'm in Santa Cruz, may I suggest surfing the wave?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, well, it's so wonderful. And what you said, that once you start operating in this manner, you know, sometimes you feel like an alien in operating in the world. But then other times, that's only when you sort of become aware of it. But then other times, you just feel this enormous love for everything, something I wrote long ago, that every permutation must exist in creation. It's all a matter of the frequencies holding it together. And we can lift, and maybe like, you know, when you're doing audio work, you can cut out the lower end bandwidth frequencies. And if we choose to lift ourselves up, you know, as a whole species together, then we can sort of do that at the higher level of consciousness. And, you know, then we will also see the change, you know, that we want to see in how we live our lives, you know, at every frequency. Does that make sense?
Yes, very much so. You know, you see that people who have done some significant work on their traumatic material, they might be operating more and more in this kind of Taoist way, sort of go with the flow, rather than enforcing their own plans on the world. And then they find out that things happen that sort of cooperate, you know, synchronicities happen that sort of ease somehow their operation. So it's more like surfing, you know, rather than trying to sort of make a tunnel, you know.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Autumn. That was great. Well, I so appreciate your taking this extra time to be with us, Stan. I'd like to keep going, but I don't want to keep everyone on too long. We do want to open up the lines at the end and say goodbye to each other, those of us who called in by phone. Before I tell you a little about what's going to be coming up next month, I want to remind you that if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at Beyond Awakening Series. com. And if you're interested in Stan's work, please read his books. You could check out the legacy paper that's available on the Beyond Awakening blog, beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. You can also visit stanislavgroff.com and holotropic.com. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com and look at my blog entries and sign up for my personal mailing list, which is a little different than the one you're on for this series, a different mailing list, terrypatton.com, and my newsletter, also my course at terrypattoncourse.com. Now, in just over 4 weeks from today, this is not at our usual time. It'll be on Monday evening, Monday, May 6th at 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm really excited to be joined in conversation by Harvard psychologist and Tibetan Buddhist teacher Daniel P. Brown. He will be talking with me and all of us about his marvelously accessible way of pointing out the teachings. They're called pointing out teachings that they open up the richness of the Indo-Tibetan path of consciousness transformation to Westerners. So thank you again, Stan, for spending this time with me and with everyone. I think we've all been really enriched by it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's open up the lines and we can all say goodbye. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
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 Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Thanks to you all.
Goodbye.
so much, Dan, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again. This is wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you.